The NSA breaks the law every day. It doesn't matter who you are or what you say. They monitor your phone calls and emails anyway. Corrupt Congress and courts paving the way. There's a lesson you'll learn someday. Watch what you say.
Shahid Buttar is a constitutional lawyer and a man who speaks truth to power in many forums, from his music to directing the Bill of Rights Defense Committee to now being the director of grassroots advocacy at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. He has been featured on numerous news outlets such as CNN, Fox, Al Jazeera, and the New York Times. Thank you for joining the Guadalajara Geopolitics podcast.
You're so very kind. I'm happy to do it.
Before we talk about some of the issues of gun control, of which you wrote about on Truthout, as well as digital privacy, for which you work with at the EFF, I'd like to set the context, which some people describe as an increasing authoritarian or totalitarian state, or creeping fascism, or a militarized police state. Do these descriptions go too far in describing the state of the U.S. government today, or do they bear merit? What are your thoughts, especially as a constitutional lawyer?
I wouldn't describe the United States as exactly a police state, though it really depends on the community that you come from, the perspective you have here. It is fair to say that in the United States, the executive branch, intelligence agencies, police departments, sheriffs, offices, highway patrol, law enforcement, and intelligence agencies have essentially unfettered power to do more or less whatever they want. And to say that the United States is not a nation of laws within that arena would not be a far stretch. To describe it as authoritarian or a police state, I fear, would entail a little bit more beyond the lack of legal restraints constraining police activities. And I think generally we've been lucky in the sense that while in the United States, profiling obviously impacts lots of different communities according to race, income status, while police have, you know, particularly as highlighted by the Black Lives Matter movement, been relentlessly violent with impunity, there is still space to organize. And I think the biggest difference between controlled police states, authoritarian states, and what we're dealing with in the United States is that we do still have space in civil society to raise our voices. And would want not to overstate the case in terms of insinuating that there are not opportunities for resistance, which in a police state or an authoritarian state look very different than what we still have available here in the U.S.
Right. Perhaps I didn't want to put it so strongly, but just that I think there's a lot of talk about this trend towards such a trajectory, and I totally agree, we still have so much room for exercising our civil liberties as opposed to many other states around the world. Would you agree with the trend, at least, though, that there are some dangers of where the government is overstepping its bounds on multiple levels?
Absolutely, more than just some, you know, many. I think that aside from the derogation of rights that we're witnessing, whether they're First Amendment rights of association that are violated by mass surveillance, or Fourth Amendment privacy rights, or whether it's the derogation of democracy by the agencies and the chilling effects of their surveillance, driving some people out of the public sphere from whom the rest of us might learn, or whether for that matter, it's literally police departments snuffing out the lives of some people. These are huge problems. I do fear the trend is worse, and I absolutely agree with you that there is a dire need for people to use what remains of our rights to make sure the erosion doesn't continue.
And one of the two issues I wanted to talk about was the Second Amendment. You're a constitutional lawyer, and you've written privately at the Truthout about this topic with your last article last month. And I think you bring up an interesting point that many people in the argument for the Second Amendment are not discussing or pointing out, and that is, I think I'll quote you. It says, "The right to bear arms no longer secures liberty because paramilitarized police preclude effective resistance even by an armed populace. While an armed populace in the 18th century could resist the federal government run amok, an armed populace in the 21st century cannot. The people versus the military-industrial complex, in other words." So what is important for people to know and to focus on regarding this issue in the Second Amendment debate, in the shadow of Eisenhower's military-industrial complex? Because, you know, they've got tactical mini-nukes and drones, and really the civilians or citizens can't really deal with that. So what's important?
That's exactly right. I think there are a couple of maybe pieces, important elements from that piece to bring out. You know, the first that I would say is most strategic for people who are concerned about policing abuses and civil rights and civil liberties to seize on is that support for those rights and liberties can come from many different directions and dimensions. The thing that actually prompted me to write the piece were reports of the Oath Keepers appearing in Ferguson. The Oath Keepers are some current but mostly retired law enforcement, some military veterans, and they have essentially taken stand against some of the federal rights abuses that concern progressives and radicals. For instance, Oath Keepers have pledged not to support or effectuate orders by the federal government to detain anyone indefinitely without trial. And that's obviously something the Pentagon has unfortunately come to do a lot, and the CIA certainly did for a long time before it was removed from the business of detention. The point there is that the Oath Keepers don't certainly see at all eye to eye with Black Lives Matter activists on a whole range of issues, but when it comes to policing abuses, they do, and there are opportunities for those novel alliances. I do think that police militarization as a phenomenon, you know, a lot of people have decried as unfortunate. The two things in the article that I really tried to emphasize first was that it's not just a problem, it is a constitutional violation. And the reason it's a constitutional violation is the paramilitary police preclude the opportunity to mount the sort of resistance that the Second Amendment was originally written to protect. And the Second Amendment is also in flux. In 2008, the Supreme Court ruled for the first time that it requires not just a right, a collective right to bear arms, but also an individual right to bear arms. And be that as it may, the origin of the Second Amendment, even conservatives would concede that the origin of the Second Amendment is rooted in a right to resistance, to protect democracy from a government run amok. The emergence of militarized police closed that door. It basically locks what is supposed to be a constitutional escape hatch. When all else fails, the Second Amendment is there. And this is very consistent with Jefferson's writings at the time and otherwise. So it's basically creating a constitutional argument to essentially challenge the militarization of our domestic policing agencies. And maybe the last thing I'd draw out there is that not only are there novel allies in the struggle to secure our rights, and not only is there a constitutional dimension to challenging policing activities. One piece I also feel the need to draw out is just that the untenability of armed resistance, because of the way in which certainly the United States, and I dare say most contemporary states are constructed, armed resistance is essentially untenable, separate from everything else. And so I'm essentially in this piece trying at the same time to suggest to people who might be inclined toward armed struggle that there may be better ways to do it, to suggest to people who are engaged in nonviolent struggle that they might have some novel allies, and to suggest to some of those allies that we might have constitutional arguments, new arrows that we might put in our quivers.
And I think if we look back in history, nonviolent resistance is always the way to go. And having groups like Oath Keepers around, again, you make the point, if the government has, you know, whatever tactical mini nukes or drones, it doesn't really serve a purpose. And we've seen the example here in Mexico with the vigilantes in Michoacán, where they have successfully forced the Mexican military to step down, which had attempted to disarm the vigilantes, who in their case, they were illegally carrying firearms, but the town pressured the military to leave. And I don't think that's an example of a permanent solution either, as you say, because there was a Mexican analyst called Macario Chetino who said, if we take a look around the world, there are no successful examples today of citizen militias that maintain permanent order. We need to have a legal state structure that preserves the peace. So I guess your focus should be on the constitutional overreach of the perhaps these paramilitary police forces. Should that be the focus then? What would be your proposal for this issue in the end? I guess, should that be the focus?
In the United States or in other countries, I think it's somewhat different takeaways.
In the U.S.?
In the U.S., I think the real takeaway is that, put simply, supporters of gun rights, that is to say conservatives concerned with the Second Amendment, they also share a stake in the fight to end police militarization. Mm-hmm. Right? And people think of the movement against police militarization in the U.S. as really driven by progressive radical communities of color that have been subjected to those abuses. I think the takeaway from this article is that even the folks who, you know, live in backwoods and think they aren't part of these social movements, if you care about the Second Amendment, you should also be worried about police becoming militarized.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a bit of an outreach piece to those communities as well.
And speaking of the social aspect, you mentioned the divide in opinion, perhaps in general, between classes and races. And I've noticed personally, you know, when I talk of some of these things to other middle class or upper class folk, especially people who are white, they think I'm crazy, or, you know, they don't see these things
right.
that are going on. And, you know, I personally have, I personally have stared down the barrel of a gun myself in the U.S. And, you know, I'm a white middle-class American, and I have been insulted and attacked by other white Americans for discussing, you know, some of the transgressions of the government. And, you know, we can, a lot of us can personally attest to this. And it's kind of, it seems like people in the middle class, or especially white people, they live in a bubble because it doesn't happen as often to, you know, the upper classes as it does to other classes. What are your thoughts there?
So you're certainly striking on one of our fundamental challenges, which is that people in the U.S. who are denied rights aren't equally subjected to those denials, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you're homeless, for instance, you're likely profiled along multiple different reasons, you know, the neighborhood you're in, the clothes that you wear, you know, the services that you might be using. There are lots of different ways that police, and this is important, impermissibly, unconstitutionally, illegally use group characteristics as a basis for suspicion. And of course, the 14th Amendment in particular is supposed to be all about the need for police to have individual bases for suspicion. You can't just say someone is suspicious because of the color of their skin, or their housing status, or where they live, or where the police happen to find them. But the reality, of course, is that that matters a lot in the United States. And if you live in the suburbs and you drive a nice car, chances are you could live your whole life and never notice the way that police treat people who live in urban centers, who don't drive, who maybe do live in low-income neighborhoods, and especially people who might face other challenges like homelessness or even not challenges, but things that might expose them to police scrutiny, like people who are organizing in their communities, for instance, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think to people who perceive the illusion of privilege, people who don't necessarily encounter these kinds of abuses themselves, one of the challenges is to notice the way that their rights are impacted too, if not their experience. And that's one of the reasons, again, I wrote this article, is to say that even if you're not facing militarized police, you have rights, and it is your rights, separate even from your experience, that are facing this erosion. Excuse me. I think there's also an opportunity with white middle-class Americans who don't see these abuses in their own lives to be educated increasingly through social media. And I do see in the emergence of the Black Lives Matter movement, the Ferguson uprising, and the discourse and debate that it has continued to stoke around the country, I see the success, at least in a narrow frame, of social media enforcing people's attention to events and issues that they might otherwise ignore and have long ignored. You know, police violence in communities of color is not new. That didn't hatch a year ago. You know, that's been going on for a long, long time. And the reason there's a discourse now and that there hasn't before is that people have been forced to witness those abuses. And I think the enabling people to witness is a huge function of social media. I do think of civilian observation of police as a really important mechanism and part of that equation. And in fact, the last piece I wrote was about police body cameras and how they're not as useful as we might think, and what we really need is civilian observation of police. And it's to enable exactly that kind of outreach and education that you're describing, or noting the lack of the opportunity for people who aren't subjected to seeing, looking down a barrel of a gun themselves, at least to see with their own eyes the experiences that other people have to confront and encounter and grapple with the dissonance they might feel then between having rights that others don't enjoy in a country that claims and stakes its international reputation on formal equality before the law.
Mm-hmm. and to look at another key component of a state that is overreaching its powers. You have surveillance, and you work for the EFF, which focuses on digital privacy. And one of your mandates at the EFF is your interest in nurturing local and college student groups focusing on technology policy to encourage, help, and connect with groups that want to host surveillance discussion groups, for example. And I work here at a university and a high school. However, I find many people are completely indifferent, and you know, they'll laugh at me like a moron when I bring up privacy. How do you respond to people who say, I don't care, let my government spy on me, I have nothing to hide?
Nothing to hide, nothing to fear. Yeah, that's a good one. You know, the first response to someone who thinks they have nothing to hide because they have nothing to fear is, do you remember our history?
Exactly.
Because the people in the United States who have had many things to fear have often had nothing to hide. Martin Luther King had nothing to hide. He not only had nothing to hide, but we have a federal holiday named after the man. He was targeted by our nation's intelligence agencies, and not just for observation. They didn't just monitor him. They tried to drive him to an early grave. And that's something that no one, quite frankly, has ever answered for. You know, the agencies do these kinds of activities with total impunity. And while there was a congressional investigation into that era, the same powers that enabled those kinds of abuses are back on the table in the last 12 years in the context of supposedly fighting terrorists. But what these powers actually do is enable the state to marginalize everything from political dissent, like they did with Dr. King, or the animal rights movement more recently. It allows the state to marginalize particular communities, like it did with the Puerto Rican independence movement or the Native American movement in the 70s, or as it has done with Muslim Americans more recently. These kinds of abuses aren't particularly targeted towards people who have done anything wrong. That's the problem. You don't have to have done anything wrong in order to become the target of these sorts of investigations. And even if you have nothing to hide, you still have a great deal to fear, because again, our history demonstrates that it's not about actual guilt. It's about dissent. It's about your membership and identification. Or it's about, you know, another example of this is the NSA. We know as a fact, because it's been reported by dozens of NSA agents and contractors, that they've used the government's very powerful spying tools monitor their former lovers or ex-wives. And you know, they haven't done anything wrong, but they have things to fear. And it is precisely because these powers are unreviewed, they are secret, they are unaccountable. That's why we all have a great deal to fear, even if we have nothing to hide. And I could add a few other different angles, if you'd like,
sure,
responding to that.
Sure. Yeah, I mean,
please.
No, I was just going to say, as you mentioned, all we have to do is look back in history and different regimes. You know, everyone always thinks of the Soviet Union or Nazi Germany. And I mean, there's all other, you know, you can look at China today. And I don't know if you've heard that they want to introduce this citizen score. There's been some reports about that where they want to give each citizen a score. And so if they criticize the government, they'll get a lower score. And they'll be denied privileges such as visas. And then if you do what the government tells you to do, you'll get a higher score, and then you'll get privileges of visas and certain things. And I don't know how true this is. It's been reported on. But as you say, I mean, and not only that, the government can often be wrong, and people get on watch lists that have done nothing wrong, and they end up not being able to fly on a plane, right?
That's exactly right. That's the denial of a very specific, you know, opportunity. And here's the thing people forget, and this would be my second response to someone who says that they have nothing to hide because they have nothing to fear. If you are being watched, you are not free, period, full stop. It doesn't matter if you have something to hide or not. You're not free if you're being monitored. The conception of freedom in the United States has grown or withered, that people forget that being subjected to mass surveillance, whether you've done anything wrong or not, it means, as a matter of fact, it's a simple definition, you are no longer free. And that's a very unsettling thing for Americans in particular to grapple with, because our nation finds so much of its esprit de corps, let's say, our national identity, and this notion of freedom, you know, the principle has very little relationship to what we in the United States encounter on a daily basis. And in other countries, I dare say, you know, obviously, I think in a lot of places, it's much worse. But the reason I raise it in this term, or in these terms, is that it's a matter of definition of freedom and how it relates to privacy. And this gets us to another angle that sort of connects those threads. When someone is silenced because they fear the outcomes of what the government or someone else might do to them if they raise their voice, they are not the only people harmed. Everyone is harmed. Our First Amendment is a constitutional recognition of that principle that we all share a collective interest in anyone having a right to speak, particularly anyone having a right to speak something unpopular. And that it's when the government is watching, when employers are getting access to that data and making their employment decisions based on, for instance, intelligence information that is kept and disseminated and retained in secret, like we know. When people fear the outcomes of what they might say, they stop speaking. And when they stop speaking, all of us are harmed. And it's a harm to our democracy more than just ourselves, right? So you sort of talk about three different angles. There's the first, which is that even if you have nothing to hide, our government often goes after people who have nothing to hide, people who've done nothing wrong. And often when I say go after, it's very vicious. The second is that the fact that you're being watched, whether you have anything to hide or not, means that you're not free. And then finally, there is a public interest in privacy beyond the individual right not to be seen or observed. So you could, for instance, you could be comfortable standing in your front window naked. That doesn't mean that privacy doesn't matter, because there's someone somewhere who wants to be able to speak and doesn't want to suffer a repercussion for it. And you have an interest in hearing that person. That's the final way in which I think everybody shares an interest in these issues, even if we might not realize it.
And I don't think you can stand in front of your window naked anymore. I don't know if you saw the news report. A couple was just...
Right, that's probably criminal in itself. Right.
No, well, they were doing just that, and they had the curtain open, and there was a drone hovering outside the window. I guess it was from a private individual.
Wow.
But you know, it's like, these things will continue, you know, to go the way they are going. But how should people push back against a surveillance state specifically? You know, one thing they can do is support EFF, which I do. I've got your stickers everywhere. And
you're very kind. You're very kind.
So, Edward Snowden.
That's great.
Uh-huh.
But I think that's just the tip of the iceberg. And supporting us as an organization, while, again, I would certainly invite that, they're much more ultimately close to home things that everybody can do. So one of the first is just promoting a discourse. That is to say, raise these issues in your community, with your friends, at the dinner table, in your organizations. And the reason that's important is because you can promote a discourse that essentially delegitimates institutional action or inaction. Put another way, this is not just a policy fight. What we're waging at the moment is, and use the term yourself earlier, the military-industrial complex, where we are waging a structural battle over essentially who calls the shots in America. Are we the people, in fact, sovereign, or instead are the national security agencies whose creator feared their ultimate actions? In the U.S. was President Eisenhower before, you know, who runs the United States? And I think that the only way for we the people to engage that, there are formal mechanisms like Congress. And so one thing people can do, everyone who cares about this issue, for instance, could take the step of meeting with their member of Congress and saying, I'm really concerned about this. That hasn't happened. I think in the vast majority of cases, people who share these concerns don't necessarily take that step. In most cases, when they do it alone. What's really impactful is if you get together with a dozen friends and neighbors, and then you pay attention, not just to your member of Congress, but to your local officials who also get presented with opportunities to take positions on these issues. It's not just the NSA and the FBI that are eroding the Fourth Amendment and the First Amendment by spying on people with no reason. It's also local police who use mass surveillance methods all the time, from automatic license plate readers to Stingray, cell site replication devices, ShotSpotter, ambient audio detection and location devices. Or you mentioned surveillance drones before. That's another set of tools that local and state law enforcement are increasingly deploying. And you don't have to wait for Congress to fix that problem. In fact, in a lot of those kinds of issues, Congress can't fix it because Congress doesn't run the Mayberry Police Department. But guess who does? Your local political representative, who doesn't normally have 20 people showing up on their door saying, hey, listen, we really care about this issue, and we're worried about the way that our public agencies, our police, are being used to spy on us. That's a huge opportunity. Local engagement of public officials in groups can absolutely change the equation. And that's just a start. You know, there's a whole range of other things people can do, from hosting crypto parties to share with your friends and neighbors tools that you can use to keep your communications private online. And if enough of us do that, that actually can functionally disable mass surveillance by simply making it untenable for the agencies to decrypt it all. And there are a number of also, I would describe as less institutional things you might do, like just to pull some examples that I've seen people do, standing outside the White House for a local governance body, like the city council, where there's a hearing happening, with light up signs that say stop spying, or doing public art in your community, for students addressing these kinds of issues in your scholarship. There's a range of ways in which people can participate. And ultimately, I think they all serve the agenda of delegitimating institutional choices not to deal with these problems. And the more of a clamor there is in the public around these issues, the more policymakers, like legislators, like members of Congress, will have to respond, the more other points in the process, like judges, will be shamed into responding. This is about a public discourse to force our institutions to do what they were built to do.
And I totally agree. There's, you know, there's those things people can get active in, as well as personal things such, you know, I use, I stopped using Gmail and I use a paid private email. I have an encrypted phone and different software, and nothing's perfect or NSA proof, but, you know, you take your money elsewhere, and as you say, it'll take, cost them much more to decrypt all of these things. I have just two more questions. What's it like speaking truth to power face to face? On a number of occasions, you have previously gotten into trouble when confronting corrupt politicians or going to different rallies, and people can look that up. You know, what's it like speaking truth to power, and why are people afraid? Why don't more people do that?
It's very liberating, I'll say that, to be able to speak your mind. And to be honest, you know, most of the time I don't get in officials' faces. You know, I aim for creative ways of protest more than the more confrontational. But, you know, like just to, I think you're referring particularly to when I asked the director of national intelligence a question on the Senate floor after the conclusion of a hearing and got arrested for it. You know, it for me, it was one of the, actually one of the best things I've ever done. it was an opportunity to just speak my mind. I didn't shrink from it. We do what the First Amendment tells us to do. And in that context, it was as much journalism, quite frankly, as anything else. I was just asking the man a question. And, you know, instead of choosing to answer, there was an arrest that happened. And to me, it was very empowering. As I would say, every opportunity to raise your voice is, whether you're writing an article, whether you're making a sign and standing on the street corner, whether you're getting together with your friends and organizing a march, all those actions are very empowering because they enable you as an individual to participate in a discourse and to do it on a level that is beyond yourself. I basically at EFF work with people on how to raise their voices. That's, you know, sort of the my shtick is working with people to help them raise their voices individually and collectively. And I think it's in that democratic exercise of our most basic rights of expression that we have the chance essentially to influence the world around us. I think a lot of us see these issues and resign ourselves to the state of affairs as if there's nothing to be changed. But, you know, just to go back to where we started this conversation a while ago, you know, think about our history. If the people all felt like that, you know, women still wouldn't have the right to vote. There wouldn't be basic civil rights, voting rights in the South. You know, these are gains we have made because people got together and spoke their minds and organized in service of expanding our most basic rights. I think of that as a time-honored tradition and to stand in that tradition, especially as an immigrant American. My family came to the United States when I was 2. I was born in England and raised in rural Missouri. And I'm very deeply patriotic. The values that the United States stands for, to me, are world-changing. And in fact, they have been world-changing. And if you take the values at their word, they're lovely. Unfortunately, our practice falls dramatically short of those words. And I think of the opportunity to defend those principles, liberty, civil and political rights, the opportunity not to be shot by a cop as you walk home, you know, from school, for instance. There's the opportunity to defend those principles, the opportunity not to be spied on when you, you know, speak your private thoughts with your partner or organize with your classmates around a social movement. These principles are ones that, to me, transcend culture and time. These are timeless issues that people around the world across human history have struggled with. And to be a part of that struggle, to me, is I can't think of any way I'd rather spend my time.
Mm-hmm. And final question, which you've already touched upon, is what words of wisdom would you have for an indifferent youth? You know, I see where I am a lot of apathy and indifference with a large part of the youth. Maybe from where you're working at, you see different things. So for them, as well as the citizen activists that will continue to deal with these threats to civil liberties, you know, what are your final thoughts, closing thoughts, as well as, you know, words of wisdom?
That's very expansive. And I guess I'll put it like this. I'd say there are three things, and very broadly, but in addition to everything else that we confront, you named apathy. I think that's one of them, and we certainly have it here in the United States elsewhere. I'll try to lay out three similar things, and I'll try to offer recommendations both for the people who suffer from those ailments and the rest of us who might be trying to engage them. So the ignorance is the first. A lot of people don't realize what is happening, right? When you get past ignorance with information, you encounter potentially apathy, people not caring. And the recommended, you know, responding to that is different. And finally, even if you do have the information, you do care, you might resign in the face of hopelessness. So ignorance, apathy, and resignation, I think, are the three enemies of any social movement, quite frankly. But in this context, I see them like this. Ignorance, one of the things that made Edward Snowden so world historically momentous is that he relieved a great many people of a very deep-seated ignorance. And spreading information is a crucial tactic, a strategy, let's say. There are a million different tactics to do that. Educating people, basically, about what is happening. That's one reason that social media has been so important in the context of enabling the Ferguson uprising and the Black Lives Matter struggle. Right? It is people becoming aware of facts that they were ignorant of before. And what that says to the rest of us is to raise these issues, to share the photos, to not shy away from opportunities to remind other people what time it is, as it were. And being an engaged participant in those discourses, if you like to writing about these issues, using your own social media profile as platforms to engage your community in these issues. Being a participant in the discussion essentially helps spread the information. The second barrier we talked about was apathy. And if someone who's feeling apathy, it's a sense, there are lots of different things that can take people to it, not the least of which, I think the biggest set of things that drive people to apathy about the state of the world is their own personal problems that preoccupy them. And so, you know, who cares about the world? Life is falling apart. I think to a great many people, particularly people of privilege, it might seem that their lives are always falling apart. The irony, of course, is that there's a very stark difference between perspective and reality there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think to people who are reaching out to people who might feel apathetic, one of the crucial opportunities is to try to invest in them a sense of hope of what it could be like if we made these words real, right? And I think to young people in particular, there is buried idealism in everyone. And I think this starts to cross into the response to resignation, which is it's about connecting people to a project larger than themselves. Right? Like if you're, you know, dealing with a breakup and you're trying to heal your heart, that's a struggle into oneself and it's profound support. When you bond together and bind together with your community and your nation and the global mass of humanity to assert the primacy of rights that we can all hold in common that will make us free, that is a grand enterprise. It cuts across millennia. you might even describe it as like a purpose of human existence, right? I mean, these are things that stretch much beyond us. They leave legacies that are magnificent. They enable one's own kids to have better lives, right? Connecting the person, the apathetic person, to other interests, whether it's future generations and their own future relatives, whether it's the people that came before them on whose shoulders they stand, whether it's their own friends and neighbors who have to deal with this stuff every day. That sort of connecting beyond the self, I think, is the most impactful response to apathy. And in the face of resignation, I think the key ingredients are hope and community. It is really easy to feel hopeless if you don't have anyone to commiserate with, if you don't have anyone else to share the struggle with, and you don't have anyone else to share the victories with and the dreams with. And I think the need for community, the opportunity for communities of resistance, that is the critical response to resignation, because it doesn't have to be miserable, right? Resistance can be beautiful and liberating and uplifting. And so just to run through those, it's information in the face of the ignorance, spreading the information, writing about these issues, talking about them on social media and in person. In the face of apathy, it's connecting people to others, whether it's their own pasts or futures or present-day neighbors and other communities. And in the face of the resignation, it's about community, hope, and celebrating the fact that we have these opportunities to come together, celebrating the rights that we do have in the struggle to recover those we've lost and gain new ones. These are some of the things we can do when reaching out to people who maybe don't yet share our concern.
Okay, so we have a template right there for which to go forward. Well, thank you, Shahid Buttar, for your time. People can follow your work at shahidbuttar.com and the Electronic Frontier Foundation. They can also follow your music there. Is there any other website you think we should check out?
I would recommend people to explore the Defending Dissent Foundation and Bill of Rights Defense Committee. But I'll certainly be happy to post things related to all those different organizations at shahidbuttar.com. You're really kind to have me on, and I just want to say one last thing to your listeners: to stay hopeful, stay loud.